Hello, this is Robert Stark. I am joined here with Bay Area Guy from Occident Invicta. Bay Area Guy, great having you back on.
Yeah, great to be back on the program.
So you wrote this essay, which I kind of commissioned you to write, called The Radical Center, and you referenced a previous interview we did. Well, the original interview we did in the last one, and we both kind of concurred about, it's about sort of mixing left and right ideology in the radical, you call it the radical center.
Because I've always had an eclectic mix of beliefs, and I don't like being ideologically pigeonholed. And even though I frequently ridicule and deride the left, that doesn't mean that I think that everything they say is without merit, especially on economic issues. So reason why we sort of concurred that the best combination would be a mix of Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader's beliefs is because, well, I think there's much to be said for the nationalism and the ideology espoused by much of the alt-right, but I do think it lacks some of the more vital components of Ralph Nader's belief system.
First of all, if you kind of identify where the American establishment is, both the left and the right like to complain. Liberals will say that the problem is that our country is too right-wing, too much inequality. And then conservatives will claim that the country is going too much in a leftist direction. But in a sense, those labels are kind of superficial because if you look at the establishment, they combine sort of the absolute worst aspects of both the left and the right. And basically what the radical center is that it's combining the best aspects of the left and the right, but the radical center is diametrically opposed to the establishment.
Well, exactly, because as you pointed out in your interview with Robert Lindsay, which I linked to in that article, what we really have is a neoliberal establishment. So on the one hand, pro-gay marriage, pro-feminism, all that jazz, and at the same time, cutthroat competition, social Darwinism in the economic realm. So they sort of combine the worst aspects of both, which is sort of kind of like a libertarianism, if you will. And what I strive to do is combine, indeed, the best aspects of both the left and the right. The right in the form of its nationalism, respect for borders and sovereignty, and the left in the form of economic justice. Because the left, as it exists today, did not always used to be this way. There used to be more leftists like our mutual friend, Robert Lindsay, who focused primarily on economics and didn't really place a high premium on all this cisgender, misgendering kind of nonsense.
This also ties in with the election. On our last show, we did talk about Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. So, as of now, are you still leaning towards Sanders, or you haven't made up your mind?
I'm leaning towards Sanders, and in fact, I think it's safe to say that I fully support Bernie Sanders for a couple of reasons. One, I'm still firmly convinced that his policies are the best economic prescription for America's recent woes, and also, I said this in the post on the radical center, and I'll say it again, but I believe that the Republicans have essentially been rendered obsolete, at least as far as presidential elections are concerned. And as excited as many segments of the alt-right may be about the rise of Donald, ultimately I think the Republican primary is irrelevant because Republicans simply don't have demographics on their side, and unless there's a really low voter turnout or a lot of voter suppression, a Democratic president is a foregone conclusion, and I would prefer that the Democrat be Sanders as opposed to Hillary Clinton.
I don't necessarily agree that Trump would lose. I think, depending on how Trump plays it, but I think Trump could win if he appeals to enough working class independents and Democrats.
Right, but he'd have to siphon off a large chunk of white Democrats and independent types. And it would be an arduous task because he's so thoroughly alienated the rising Latino vote. General election, he's going to face a bit of an uphill battle, so he'd really have to make significant inroads.
Well, as far as Sanders goes, I like a lot of Bernie Sanders' ideas about Wall Street and some of his ideas about like taxing, having a Tobin tax on financial transactions. But my concern is, like, let's say hypothetically he becomes president. The good things about Bernie Sanders, he could fail at that because the power of Wall Street is so strong. But he could end up doing some really terrible things, too. I mean, some of Bernie Sanders has good ideas, but he also has some terrible ideas. Like he said he wants to give amnesty and then make all those people immediately eligible for free health care.
Right, and of course, especially in an American context, some of his ideas seem pretty crazy. And I'm hardly saying that Sanders is perfect, definitely the best option, because otherwise you would probably end up with Hillary Clinton, who is a downright shill for Wall Street and who's accepted millions in speaking fees from Wall Street. So, yes, the prospect of a Hillary Clinton presidency certainly unsettles me, so I hope that Bernie Sanders prevails.
So, basically, with this article, obviously, but neither Bernie Sanders nor Donald Trump are ideal. They both have flaws. We're talking about combining the best aspects of both of them, but better yet, obviously, I have far more respect for Pat Buchanan or Ralph Nader than I do for Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. But those individuals do not get the same level of support that Trump and Sanders are. Ideal, you're getting at, is to combine the best aspects of Pat Buchanan and Ralph Nader. Do you think that there is a large ideological demographic for those ideas, or do you think people are still sort of caught up in their own camp, whether it's the progressive sort of left camp or the sort of conservative like Tea Party camp or even the alternative right? Do you think there's sort of a strong enough demographic for like a radical center?
I think there just may very well be, because if the popularity of Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders are indications of anything, it's that growing numbers of Americans, both left and right, are getting fed up with the status quo, with the consensus. So even if, and I've even read some articles to the effect that many people feel like supporting Trump, not so much because they harbor any genuine pro-Trump convictions, but rather because, sort of like the Joker in The Dark Knight, they sort of want to see the world burn. So there's a lot of disaffection out there. And I think that if you sort of crafted this radical center message that resonates with growing numbers of people, I think it really could catch on.
Yeah, absolutely. I think if you had a good organization and marketed, just very few people are talking about it. I know that the term radical centrism has been co-opted by the establishment. What's his name? Look at his first name. He's a writer for the New York Times. I know his last name is Friedman. And
Thomas
he's basically
Friedman?
Thomas Friedman, right. He's basically like a neoliberal globalist type, but he uses the term radical centrist to describe himself. So he's sort of stolen that term. But the concept, I guess the closest to it would be like what Ross Perot and what he did with the Reform Party was a sort of radical centrist movement, and I think he appealed to that demographic. But the problem is that was only a one-time election, And when he was done running, that whole movement just fell apart. But I think if you organize, I think there could be potential for a radical centrist movement.
Right, and if my own observations are anything, and keep in mind these are just anecdotes, but based on conversations I've had with people, I think there are growing numbers of people who are economically frustrated, but at the same time don't think too highly of SJWs or the identity politics wing of the Democratic Party. And I think that if you sort of marketed your message to them properly, then they might just be inclined to follow, even here in the Bay Area.
So do you talk to a lot of people up there in the Bay Area, like personal friends, about your views?
Not quite. I reveal some of my views, but I certainly don't divulge my entire belief system or the existence of my, aside from a select few close and trusted friends. That might get me into a few complications.
Yeah. So you're probably the only person in the alternative right to endorse Bernie Sanders.
Yeah, I'd say so, and I don't apologize for it because, like I said in that the article I wrote that you commissioned me to write, I don't think one should have to rigidly adhere to any ideological purity or conform to every alt-right talking point just to remain in the good graces of the community.
And with the alternative right, it's not like you're officially part of this movement. I guess like both you and I are sort of loosely affiliated with this movement because it's closer to our views than anything else. I mean, it's obviously closer to our views than the mainstream right, the mainstream left, or even libertarians. So it's not.
Oh yeah.
It's not like
especially
a
libertarians.
Perfect,
but,
it's not like a perfect coherent movement, but it's the closest out of everything out there. It makes the most sense.
Yeah, I'd say so. On a fundamental level, I'm on the alt-right side. It's just that I don't agree with certain positions that they espouse, but that's fine. We're entitled to have disagreements. That doesn't mean we still can't be friendly, and you're right, I'm not officially. Well, I kind of do consider myself a member of the alt-right, but I'm not really part of any official club. I write on my blog posts, and if my posts have any value, then they're reposted on alternative right, but that doesn't mean I take orders from the alt-right headquarters, if such a thing even existed.
I think as opposed to other movements like libertarianism, I think the alternative right, and there's exceptions, of course, but I think it can be like a big tent movement. I don't think that they're less rigid in enforcing their views than other larger, more established movements.
Right, and of course it also needs to be said that there's a difference between your standard run-of-the-mill alt-right commenter and the alt-right intelligentsia as represented by people such as Colin Liddell, Andy Nowicki, and Richard Spencer. And while some of my articles have indeed been attacked by certain random commenters, Colin, Andy, and others have nevertheless appreciated some of the things I've written, even if I state a certain position that's sort of runs contrary to standard alt-right talking points.
Back to the election, you were still saying like Republicans refuse to stymie the tide of immigration. Are you saying that demographic change is inevitable and that we should just sort of accept it?
Well, short of mass deportations, I believe it is, because it's not just Latinos either, because whenever anyone speaks of immigration, they always treat it as a matter of illegal immigrants from Mexico coming in and dropping a lot of anchor babies. There's also a large amount of immigration from Asia, and I even read somewhere that Asians are now the largest immigrant group. So, yeah, demographics, unless you just completely hermetically seal the borders and deport a whole lot of people or find some way to raise the white birth rate, if current trends continue unabated, then, yeah, demographic change is inevitable, and most of these new Americans are going to probably gravitate towards the Democrats.
That basically is the number one focus of the alternative right. The number one focus of the alternative right is basically race and opposing white dispossession.
Well, yes, and it's certainly understandable because few other people are talking about these issues, and the mainstream media only reports about the demographic decline of whites when they are basically mildly celebrating it, saying that, you know, we're becoming more diverse, we're becoming more vibrant, this is a beautiful development, and all these young minorities are going to rejuvenate the U.S. economy. But it's really only those of us on the alt-right who say that, well, with whites becoming a minority, this could pose some very serious challenges for our people, and we need to really consider what the long-term existential consequences might be. So I think the alt-right does indeed serve a very valuable function in this respect.
You said that the alt-right embodies the best aspects while lacking the better qualities of Ralph Nader. You said that your critique with the alt-right is that they mostly neglect economic matters, but you said Hunter Wallace and Matt Forney are the exceptions.
Right. Hunter Wallace has actually been writing many posts recently about global trade, globalism, libertarian economics, and these raw trade deals that disenfranchise American workers. And, of course, Matt Forney wrote the post on Mark Ames where he discusses economic dispossession following the Reagan Revolution. But sadly, I feel like they're more of the exception. And I should also note that it's not surprising that Wallace and Forney tend to be younger than many members of the alt-right intelligentsia. So I think at least for our when it comes to our focus on economics, it's a lot of it's due to a generational divide.
Yeah, because you mentioned a lot of older alt-right individuals like Jared Taylor and Kevin McDonald. They have sort of their focuses. They don't really talk that much about economics.
Right, so they can't really relate to what's going on as much. But I will just say this. Can't really divorce the issue of economics from race, immigration, or any of these other issues, because why do you think we have so much immigration right now, or at least had a tremendous amount of immigration? Because of employers' desire for cheap labor, because of this unfettered global capitalism. So if you can complain about Mexicans trying to cross the border and all, but at the same time, you have to ask yourself, well, who's hiring these people? Who wants to bring them in? And that's where the economic issue comes in.
You talk about economics, and you've talked about this a lot, economic policy and corporate interests as like a driving force behind a lot of that. Do you get into sort of specific economic policies that you're interested in?
I feel like, well, I mean, besides imposing certain radical laws, that employers who knowingly hire illegal immigrants will face stiff penalties, which probably won't happen anytime soon. I feel like there just needs to be fundamental changes to the economic structure, and not just in terms of tax policy. The real problem right now is that we sort of have a monopolization of economic power in the airline industry, telecommunications, internet providers, and there's too much concentrated wealth and power, and much of this has been exacerbated by the rise of the internet. So in many ways, we're basically living in a new Gilded Age. So I think what we really need is a new antitrust movement.
I think even Bernie Sanders, even he has talked about breaking up the banks. But what is interesting about, one thing about Bernie Sanders that is fascinating is he enjoys the most support among white millennials and millennials in general. Most of Trump's support is from older people.
Right. Well, I think that for Trump's appeal among older people, he sort of does galvanize them, since he sort of brings them back to an earlier time when not all mainstream white male politicians were always walking on eggshells and always PC, and he sort of brings back, he sort of invokes nationalism and a time when America was a whiter, more, less PC country. And I think that more than any other reason, a lot of white voters support Donald Trump because of the sort of the cultural affirmation that he provides them.
And I think Donald Trump, I mean, whatever you can say, whatever you say like about him, like despite all that, I think Donald Trump is sort of genuinely nostalgic for that era he grew up in. He grew up in the 1960s and he reached his pinnacle in the 1980s. So I think he personally has seen that decline in the country. So I think Donald Trump, I mean, he's not, whatever you say about him, he's not a puppet like the other candidates. I do think he's an extreme narcissist, but I think he does have this mentality that his narcissism is driving him to the point where he's like, yeah, I want to go down in history as a man who saved America. I think he does, like, have that. Well, Hillary and Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, they just want to be president just for the sake of being president.
Right, and, well, I mean, first of all, how many politicians aren't narcissists? And I think the fact that politics has such a bad rap nowadays means that people like Trump, who sort of unapologetically wear their narcissism on their sleeves, actually, they make more inroads with voters who sort of know the game is rigged. And Trump is basically saying, yeah, the game's rigged, and yeah, I'm kind of a sleazy, rich narcissist, but I'm a sleazy, rich narcissist who fights for you and sort of brings these other sleazy, rich narcissists to heel. So I think that he's sort of embracing that role as a fighter, as someone who can sort of wage war against his own corrupt elite class. And that's sort of how, miraculously, a billionaire in the worst economy since the Great Depression can run a semi-populist campaign.
So, on the issue of the alternative right, you do talk about some of your criticisms of the alternative right. One thing you said to me, I don't know how much you want to get into this, but in our conversation earlier, you were saying you also have a lot of criticisms of the Manosphere, which is kind of a movement that overlaps with the alternative right.
Right, because I'm specifically referring to the whole Ayn Randian sentiment that you see in certain parts of the alt-right, this whole social Darwinistic, radically individualistic. And I feel like there's a lot of libertarian types in the Manosphere. And I think the problem is that there's an inherent contradiction because on the one hand, you complain about cultural degeneracy and societal decay, and yet you sort of embrace this libertarian, hyper-individualistic dog-eat-dog mentality. And needless to say, that's not very conducive to a healthy society.
You also think that the alternative right is too, you said that they're too obsessed with like the Jewish issue?
Yes, I would definitely say that. And here's the thing. I don't deny that certain Jewish activists have played a harmful role in fostering many of the pathologies we currently bemoan. But at the same time, I think that blaming Jews is a bit of a cop-out because, on the one hand, many on the alt-right frequently assert that whites are this amazing, intelligent race and we forged the modern world, and yet we're so gullible and weak-willed that we allowed a tiny cabal of Jews to completely undermine us. And I just don't buy it. And I also think that even if Jews really were as active and diabolical as certain alt-righters claim, they would have not been able to push their agendas in any non-Western setting. And there's something about Western culture that sort of allows for this all this liberal insanity that we're currently witnessing.
Yeah, I know you're probably going to get some flack from the alternative right for supporting the first Jewish president.
Well, I mean, here's the way I see it. These, in the mind of these certain alt-righters whom I would presumably receive flack from, they already believe that Jews basically control the country, so why not add a Jewish president to the mix? Doesn't make any difference.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, I've actually heard some of them say that. That's more honest than having, like, than a puppet. Yeah.
Yeah. But regarding the Jewish question, that actually brings me to another point, because while the alt-right likes to focus on many external existential threats to whites in the form of either Jewish activism or mass immigration, I also feel like they sort of neglect many sort of homegrown white cultural pathologies that are causing harm. And I recently wrote about the suicide epidemic among middle-aged white Americans, especially those without college degrees. So having sort of done more research on the United States compared to other first world developed countries, and having sort of analyzed just how rotten the situation is for the average person, I feel like more than, instead of just blaming outsiders, you have to sort of recognize that there's something wrong with America, and there's a reason why white Americans live worse than their counterparts in other rich countries, and you can't pin that on the Jews.
Yeah, and with the suicide rate, it's not just about economics, because economics definitely is a major part of it, because those people are being economically decimated, but lower class white men have a much higher suicide rate than lower class black or Hispanic men. So I think the key issue is that they're more likely to, is the hyper-individualism, and that they're more likely to be alienated and not have a community that's looking out for them.
Oh, absolutely. And that's actually one of the reasons I cited for the suicide epidemic, because, yeah, when it's sink or swim and you're sinking on your own, then those kinds of feelings can be unbearable. And I think another factor is also at play. You have this whole Protestant work ethic, bootstrap myth mentality, where so many white Americans believe that anyone, so long as they work hard, can make it and succeed. And so, of course, when you're not making it, when you're suffering, not only are you broke and miserable, but society in so many ways basically says, well, that's your fault. You're just a lazy bum. You're just worthless. And since whites are far more likely to embrace the whole bootstrap myth than other groups, then I think that also can take a toll for white people who are struggling.
That is interesting. I know that if you look at suicide rates, they're actually a lot lower in Catholic countries, in Latin America and the Catholic parts of Europe. I think the highest suicide, I know Russia has a high suicide rate, and they've traditionally been Eastern Orthodox, but a lot of people there are atheists after communism, but, I mean, the United States has a high suicide rate. I know England and Scandinavia have high suicide rates, but in general, like, Catholic countries have lower suicide rates.
Yeah, and it doesn't surprise me in the least, because there has always been something about Protestantism that sort of associates God's favor with material prosperity, especially with Calvinism, and since Calvinism has always been a dominant strain of thought in the U.S., now it's more secularized, of course, but since that mindset has always been pervasive, then are far more likely to sort of beat themselves up when things don't go their way.
I don't even think that the Protestant work ethic is necessary to have a prosperous society. There's plenty of Catholic parts of Europe that have traditionally been very prosperous. I mean, Examples would be Bavaria, Austria, Switzerland, Northern Italy.
Right, and I mean, I can understand where this Protestant work ethic comes from, at least in an American context, because centuries ago when the United States was a young, rapidly expanding country, perhaps more of that frontier, rugged individualist mentality was needed, and you sort of needed to create a lot of wealth in a new land full of immigrants. But now that the U.S. is settled and established, I think this rugged individualism in many ways has lost its meaning and no longer really applies issue in context. But I do think that American culture, needless to say, is nowadays hyper-individualistic, and I think it's gone off the rails. And as George Costanza from Seinfeld likes to frequently say, you know, we live in a society. You know, you can't have a functioning society free of cultural degeneracy when you individuals running around each pursuing their own selfish interests. At some point, something's got to give.
You also wrote about this, about spree shootings, and after that shooting happened in Oregon, you said that the root cause of these shootings was the same issue as the hyper-individualism of American culture, and the same, basically it's the same reason as suicide, because most of these shooters go on to commit suicide, so that issue ties them together.
Yeah, absolutely. And whenever one of these shootings occurs, you always have the same chattering classes always trying to push their whole narrative about why these types of shootings occur. Among liberals, they always say that, oh, if only you restrict guns, then these types of things would not happen. And then you also have some people, especially in the manosphere, saying, well, if only this guy knew game and could get a date, that, you know, game saves lives. And so, and you even have a few NRA types who claim that, well, if only the victims had been armed, then they could have defended themselves. But the thing is that in many other parts of the world, there's also gun ownership, and there have always been lonely, unsuccessful men in all parts of the world. And yet, it's only in the U.S. where these types of shootings occur with any regularity. So that tells me that there's something about American culture that is fundamentally broken.
Yeah,
you just know that something's wrong when people in the most free, supposedly free, prosperous society in history decide to go postal.
I mean, it's a combination of this social atomization, but there's also this sort of explicit message that if you don't live up to this potential, that you're a total failure.
Right, it rubs salt in wounds, it adds to injury.
On this issue of being a radical centrist, would you kind of say one way to look at it would be to combine, another way to look at it would be to kind of combine the alternative right and Robert Lindsay's alternative left?
Perhaps, but I find the whole idea of the alternative left kind of humorous, because I'm not trying to in any ways deny that Robert Lindsay is a very complex individual with many radically diverging viewpoints, as he likes to describe himself. But in many ways, people like Robert were not so rare back in the early 20th century. The old left used to be synonymous with labor, economics, and those kinds of bread and butter issues. And that's what Robert's all about. So the only reason why Robert's politically homeless and even possibly feels the need to create an alternative left is because today's left has just grown so unhinged with its embrace of identity politics that more sane economic leftists like Robert sort of have to find their own group.
I know, like, Robert Lindsay, like, will actually, he'll go as far as to ban commentators on his blog for promoting right-wing economics.
Yeah, although he did make, yeah, and he normally also bans you if you support the Republicans, although he did make an exception for Donald Trump on account of Trump's trade policies. But yeah, when Robert says right-wing and when he bans right-wing commenters, he's almost always referring to libertarian Ayn Randian types. He doesn't really mean alt-right, right-wing types?
Well, he actually doesn't censor racist comments.
Yeah, I mean, Robert has a pretty flexible set of commenting rules. I mean, so long as you don't insult him or any other contributors personally, and as long as you're not a complete troll and asshole, then you'll do fine.
What are some of the responses that you've gotten about to the Radical Center?
Well, kind of interesting because I had a brief little exchange with one of my commenters, Dutchman, and he sort of thought that, yeah, it would be great, but it's not really possible anymore to sort of create a radical center that draws in large numbers of people. And I pointed out that in the early 20th century, it wasn't unheard of for people to embrace radically divergent, disparate ideologies. I mean, take the Bay Area writer Jack London, for example. That guy, on the one hand, was a very extreme racist, and believe me, I never use that word lightly. I mean, yeah, he actually advocated the extermination of the Chinese, so he was the real deal. And yet, London was also a radical socialist, so, and even though he was very extreme, a lot of members of the old left in the early 20th century were not that radically different from Jack London. So there is a historical precedent for some kind of radical center.
As far as social issues go, you're obviously against like social justice warriors and political correctness. Do you think the radical center should focus on being socially moderate?
Well, I don't know about that. I do think some measure of social conservatism, albeit moderated, should be in effect. But I think that if the alt-right were to tone down some of its messages about Jews and HBD and all that stuff, then if they sort of approached growing numbers of regular white Americans with a more sane social message, but that's fundamentally nationalistic, and they also discuss economics more, then I think there is tremendous potential to reach out to more and more alienated white masses.
And not just sort of the traditional sort of right-wing demographic that a lot of people who don't have a voice, or even a lot of the people who are currently voting for Sanders.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I read a study suggesting that even whites who are Democratic might conservative if they feel beleaguered, because I sort of read a study where they sort of interviewed and monitored a couple of regular standard white liberals from Boston. But then, during their daily routine, such as riding a train, they would have a couple of illegal immigrants sit on the train in their presence. And just the very presence of those immigrants caused these otherwise liberal whites to start to adopt more of a semi-bunker mentality, more conservative views. So I think that there's definitely a lot of potential there.
And if you look at, like, a lot of the political parties in Europe that are considered right-wing, if you look at Marine Le Pen in France, I mean, she's just called right-wing because she's anti-immigration. If you look at her other policies besides immigration, she basically pretty much fits the mold of, like, a radical centrist.
Pretty much, and you could actually say the same thing for Erdogan in Turkey, who's populist AKP recently regained complete power. And Erdogan combines both nationalism but also economic populism, and the standard of living for the average Turk has risen under his reign. So it is possible to combine both, just not currently in the United States.
Well, you have this post, diversity is simply a code word, non-white, and you you basically talk about it. It's used like an area that is maybe 90% black would be described as diverse, but that's not really true diversity.
No, absolutely not. And I should actually maybe amend that my title, and instead of saying diversity is simply code for non-white, I should say that diversity is specifically code for black and brown, because Asians, for some reason, don't qualify as diverse. And the Bay Area is a perfect example, because take Silicon Valley. You always hear leftists complaining about the lack of diversity in Silicon Valley and how there's not enough people of color in Silicon Valley. But having looked at the stats, Asians at major companies such as Facebook, Google, Yahoo, they're at least 30% of the population or above, and non-whites as a whole are over 30% of America's population. So non-whites, the percentage of non-white workers in Silicon Valley tech companies are high, but there aren't that many blacks and Latinos, so you always hear them complaining about no diversity. So they have a very restricted notion of what constitutes diversity, to say the least.
Well, I think for a lot of sort of white sort of swipple types, their ideal community would be maybe like 60% white and the remaining 40% being super diverse. They obviously don't want to live in the ghetto. So I think
right.
they have this sort of ideal balance of diversity, but they're just not honest about it.
Right, and I read an interesting study where both the majority of white people and blacks desire integrated neighborhoods. But of course, like you said, they have different notions of what constitutes a diverse integrated neighborhood. So whites kind of want a neighborhood where there's, say, 60 to 70%, and they can interact with people of different groups, but they're still sort of the dominant group in that neighborhood. Whereas blacks and others see a diverse neighborhood as being equally divided between non-white and white, with maybe even non-whites being a slight majority. And so that's why, even though they both say they want integrated neighborhoods, they're only willing to concede so much in order to achieve them.
A lot of people on the alternative right, they sort of, a lot of them demand like a community that's like 100% homogenous. But I mean, that's not realistic. That's not really realistic either. But I know, you heard that famous kind of a quote by John Derbyshire, his analogy for diversity, he compares it like to a spice. In a certain amount, it's a good thing. But if you pour a large amount of a spice into like a cuisine, you would totally wreck it. I mean, which camp are you personally in?
I'm in the Derbyshire camp because, one, I've actually grown up around diversity. So even though I think too much diversity is problematic, I think that diversity, if managed and if existing in the right context, it can work to some extent. But I think the problem is that when you just have so much untrammeled immigration and when whites are being rendered a minority, that's when it becomes problematic. And also, the whole idea of creating a 100% white community is a pure pipe dream, because every empire is going to be diverse in one manner or another. And even various nationalistic, un-PC empires throughout history have had immigration, have had diversity. I mean, if you invade the world, you invite the world. So I think...
Even if you look at Israel, which is a lot of people, including people on the alternative right, consider Israel to be a very racist state. But I mean, Israel's not 100% homogenous. I mean, Israel's about a quarter of their population is Arab. So obviously, you're not going to have a 100% homogenous society.
Right, and it should also be mentioned that even within Israel's Jewish population, it's not homogenous at all, and there have actually been recent attacks committed against Israelis who were mistaken for being Arab, because a lot of Israel's population is comprised of Mizrahi, Jews, i.e. Middle Eastern Jews from Arab countries and beyond. So Israel, I think in terms of absolute numbers, if you include Palestinians in the West Bank and if you include all the Mizrahi Jews, all the various immigrants that Israel's received recently, then Israel's actually majority non-white. So Israel is definitely not homogenous, despite their pretensions.
Yeah, I mean, Israel's probably maybe like 40% white, probably.
Yeah, and the secular Ashkenazi population is a dwindling demographic there.
So basically, I mean, I've had sort of had the same experience. I grew up in L.A., so you're pretty used to being in diverse environments yourself.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I just need to say that I do not bear any hostility towards Latinos, Asians, or other groups. And I've interacted with them, hung out with them as individual people. They're just fine. But here's the question. Do I want to live in a society where Latinos and Asians are the majority and wield political power? No. So when I criticize diversity and when I espouse alt-right talking points, I don't do it out of hostility. It's just pure self-interest and sort of a tribal survival instinct.
Yeah, I mean, those are very reasonable positions to take. You just have to, just how you communicate your message.
Right, and I think the alt-right could do that much better if they dropped certain problematic talking points.
You do have this post, How to Win by Refusing to Say Sorry, and this is about Viktor Orban in Hungary and his refusal to bow down to Germany's moral imperialism to accept the refugee quotas.
Right, and he's fully justified in doing so because unlike Western countries like the U.S., Hungary played absolutely no role in displacing people in the Middle East. They have absolutely nothing to do with the current refugee crisis, so it's kind of shameful to demand that these poorer Eastern European countries burden themselves with refugees that they played no role in creating. And of course, I think it's especially shameful that Germany lectures Balkans and Eastern European countries about opening their hearts to all these newcomers, and yet at the same time, they basically condemn Greece to third world debt slavery.
You mentioned, I mean, you're of Greek descent. Do you have strong personal connections to Greece, or not really?
Especially most of all of my Greek relatives are American-born. But I will say this, the way Germany has treated Greece recently, it sort of has lowered my opinion of Germany, despite being of partial Germanic descent.
One thing Robert Lindsay has written about is he's written about, Nordicism. Do you think that what do you think about the whole sort of concept of Nordicism of, Nordics versus Mediterranean Europeans?
Well, I think it's profoundly idiotic, and one of my former unhinged commenters who has long been banned, in one email he sent to me, he even said that if the white utopia were ever created, I, being of partial Greek descent, would be deported to Greece and would be permitted visitation rights. So a lot of Nordicism is just idiotic because you're complaining about how whites are a dying people, low birth rates and what have you, and yet you would exclude even more people from your ranks. It just doesn't make sense. I don't really see it too often. You just have to look at American Renaissance, where Jared Taylor is. Many speakers at American Renaissance Conference have actually been Jews, people like Michael Levin, Michael Hart, or someone of Italian descent like Frank Borzilieri. So I think that the only people who really pursue this Nordicist stuff seriously are more of the unhinged troll type of commenters.
You have this post, A Prostitution and Meth, A Tale of two crises. And this was in reference to an Al Jazeera article where it talks about the Swedish model of tackling sex trafficking and prostitution, basically where they decriminalize the selling of sex, but they let the hookers off the book while penalizing the buyers. And you quote the great late comedian George Carlin, who what did George Carlin say? Give the sack.
Well, there's so many words. What Carlin he basically said that, you know, why is it illegal to sell something that you can just give away for free? And that was his argument. He said, you know, we give medals to people who kill children with napalm, but then we send you to jail just for getting an orgasm. And there's something, there's no logic to it. But yeah, the reason why I wrote that article was because I'm not really interested in the whole topic of prostitution, but it's just another example of how feminists and leftists basically absolve women of any and all responsibility, because to hear them tell it, all prostitutes are these exploited victims who have to cater to the depraved sexual demands of evil men and whatnot. And yet the reality is that a lot of these women go into, it's very financially lucrative, and a lot of Wall Street escorts can make bank just for working for 1 hour. So I think that in the eyes of feminists, as Dota once pointed out, they actually prefer that women are sort of treated as children who are not held accountable for their actions.
So this article is more geared towards them than social conservatives?
Yes, definitely.
When it comes to these issues of vice, like that we brought up, like do you have a kind of libertarian streak about, like, when it comes to vice, or are you more socially conservative?
Well, as much as I generally detest libertarianism, I do have a bit more of a libertarian streak on these types of issues, because I think that it's very dangerous to allow the government to dictate morality and to dictate certain practices, because the kind of government that would outlaw prostitution is the same kind of government that would impose these draconian consent laws, which they've already done in California. So, I mean, as Dota told me in a private conversation, consent nonsense, which originates from the same puritanical mindset that drives anti-prostitution laws. Basically, by allowing the government into the bedroom, it sets a very bad precedent.
I know Matt Forney brought this up in a previous interview I did with him. He was kind of discussing about how a lot of people see social conservatives as being the ones who are authoritarian, but laws dealing with sexuality have become more authoritarian, coinciding with the degeneration of society. And we've seen sort of a big increase in the police state. He was making sort of giving an example where he was traveling abroad, and he was visiting a country that was much more socially conservative, yet he felt more free.
Right, and I believe the country Matt Forney visited was the Philippines.
And
yeah, it's kind of
right.
Ironic, and Dota actually told me this when talking about India, but there's actually a certain freedom in some level of chaos, because I feel like in the U.S. you indeed are, it's very stultifying. You have to abide by all these regulations and red tape, and it's not really that free, honestly. Unless, of course, you're one of the wealthy elites.
Yeah, I was reading about this case, and I think it was in Massachusetts. This man was taking pictures of nature out in a park, and this woman accused him of being a pedophile, and she called the cops on him. And he didn't get arrested, but the cops, like, harassed him, and, like, they asked to see his camera and look for his pictures. And he wasn't doing anything sinister. He was just taking pictures, like, of nature.
Yeah, and that, again, that doesn't surprise me in the least. And you also hear stories about how kids, well, boys, I should say, in elementary school are suspended or otherwise punished just for pretending to shoot someone with a finger gun or something along those lines. And going back to George Carlin, to quote him again, in one of his 1999 stand-ups, he basically said that what's happening in the U.S. is that we have an increasingly neurotic population obsessed with safety, security, cleanliness, crime, drugs, even germs. And I feel like the U.S. Americans are just very paranoid about security compared to people in most of the world, even though probably have less to fear than most people around the planet.
So you wrote this article called The Importance of Historical and Global Awareness, Your Brief Thoughts on 1984. So this was actually inspired by Dota's older posts on the book 1984 by George Orwell.
Yes, that's correct. And in many ways, I was inspired to read it again because I had actually read the book as a student in high school, but at the time I wasn't really able to grasp its deeper meanings. The only thing I really took away from it was that totalitarianism's bad, censorship is bad. And yet when I read the book now, I feel like the lessons in that novel resonate more with me today and aren't quite as applicable. I mean, they're more applicable today than you would realize. They're not just confined to the totalitarian era of the 20th century.
Yeah, usually in a class they teach it, they make the comparison that the book is in reference to totalitarian regimes of the 20th century. The obvious examples like National Socialism and Communism. But usually the comparison to modern society is not as made as much. In the article, do you get into the difference between like hard totalitarianism, which the book describes, and sort of soft totalitarianism, which is what our society is today, with some aspects of hard totalitarianism as well mixed
well,
in with it?
I don't actually really get into soft totalitarianism or any mechanisms of rule. Rather, I sort of describe certain cultural and societal conditions that help engender certain oppressive conditions. Ignorance of the global, of the world being a chief example. So I thought the most fascinating part of the book was, well, the book within a book written ostensibly by dissident Emmanuel Goldstein, where he sort of talks about the history of nations and, well, Dota already made this point in his original review, the whole idea of continual warfare. And Dota doesn't quite get into this in his own post, but what I found interesting was that he said that continual warfare and the lack of any genuine external threat, it sort of causes nations to decay in a way, because when confronted with an external foe that could legitimately conquer you or subjugate you, a leader cannot be entirely despotic or entirely feckless or tyrannical. He must exercise some good leadership, but absent a historical threat, I mean an external threat, then you don't really have to be as sharp. And in many ways, that makes me think about the United States in the aftermath of the Soviet Union's fall.
So basically, we had that period. So that was during the Clinton era, in between the fall of the Soviet Union and up until 9/11, when the American people did not really feel threatened by any foreign power.
Right, and I think it really helped create this certain sense of imperial hubris, and it was a disaster on both the economic and foreign policy fronts, because the Soviet Union sort of acted as a check on U.S. or global neoliberal economic ambitions. But ever since the Soviet Union fell, that sort of opened up the door for big corporations and other elites.
Part of the reason why the government during the World War II and the Cold War they did some policies that did benefit the working and middle classes, because they were worried that if they totally screwed over the masses, there would be some kind of rebellion and that people would rise up and be supportive of these enemy regimes like fascism and communism. But once the Cold War ended, their attitude was basically just give the middle finger to the people and let the elites just basically rape the masses.
Yeah, pretty much. And a lot of people seem to think that we sort of lived in this economic golden age and that Ronald Reagan sort of took it all away. It was a paradise lost. And I'm hardly defending Reagan, but if you think about it, the U.S. worker has only really had it good for around, say, 4 decades from the New Deal era up until the 70s. And I think that the shock of the Great Depression and the threat posed by the Axis powers in World War II, it, like you said, forced American elites to toss the working man a bone.
Basically, my view on FDR is nuanced. On one hand, I mean, the left worships him and the right despises him as like a commie. But my basic view of him is that he was a power-hungry plutocrat, but at the same time, he realized that in order to stay in power, he did have to do some things to help the workers. So I have more of a nuanced view towards FDR.
Well, that's interesting, because one commenter on Robert Lindsay's blog, he sort of had a similar assertion regarding Trump. He said that Trump's a plutocrat, but he's a smart plutocrat. He's seen how elites in third world countries live, and he doesn't want to have to go around driving on cracked roads and having to have security defend him. And he figures, well, you either can pay more taxes now and give the regular people something now, or you potentially risk provoking a revolution and then you lose everything. So I think some of the more trenchant elites are cognizant of this fact. And anyway, to get back to the whole point of external threats in 1984, I think the reason why today's elites are so avaricious and completely disconnected from their nation is because since the U.S. emerged as the dominant hegemonic superpower, the U.S. wasn't really under any threat. And so my take is that elites figured, well, we can just outsource and enrich ourselves to our heart's content, and there's no longer any national imperative to invest in American citizens.
And in this article, you say that most Americans have sort of mastered the art of doublethink. They proclaim themselves to be free and independent, but they toil at jobs that they hate, and they work paycheck to paycheck, and they binge on credit to buy just lots of consumer goods that they don't need. So that basically describes like soft totalitarianism. In the book, 1984, there definitely is a lot of that aspect of, there's both like aspects of how people are conditioned to be a certain way, but the book also gets into soft, hard totalitarianism, like the second chapter where Winston is like tortured. And we guess we do torture people too, so that is accurate.
Well, for now we mainly confine our torturing to enemy combatants, but could definitely happen here at some point in the future. But anyway, regarding soft totalitarianism, I feel like a lot of Americans have a very one-dimensional view of freedom, because when many Americans speak of freedom, they mainly mean freedom not to get jailed by the government for saying something critical. And yet, so many Americans sort of seem to lose this sense of freedom when it comes to the workplace, because, yeah, sometimes you'll speak out against the government and it's great to have protections, but on a day-to-day level, you're going to be interacting much more extensively with your employer. And after having read Mark Ames's book, Going Postal, and having done my own independent research on the situation of American workers, it really is kind of appalling just how poorly the average American citizen is treated compared to his counterparts in other rich countries. And so when Americans say that they're the freest, most independent people in the world, I don't really know what they mean.
The other thing with 1984 is how people in the book are, like, dumbed down. But in the book, it's very explicit. So people are being... It sort of is similar how people are being dumbed down. And even with... I mean, all this information is out there on the internet. People have freedom to access basically anything. Most people are completely ignorant about, like, world affairs and about history.
Right, and American society does little to encourage intellectual curiosity or a wider understanding of the world. They sort of want people to remain ignorant about global events, and our elites don't really want informed citizens. And I'm not trying to sound all tinfoil hat or anything, but, well, I feel like what 1984, more than teaching us about the evils of totalitarianism or censorship, I think what it really hammers home is that by controlling, a lot of it has to revolve around controlling consciousness. In his post on 1984, Dota mentioned the deliberate restriction of language as a means of controlling thought. And likewise, I feel that cutting off people from knowledge about foreign countries and global events, that's another way of limiting consciousness, because if you aren't aware of alternatives, well, then you're more inclined to put up with nonsense at home. So I think if you really want to resist our elites and create a new alternative, you need to sort of just expand your consciousness. And whether that's expanding your vocabulary or learning more about history or traveling, then those are all good means to do so.
So basically, kind of to summarize the show, the Radical Center does kind of touch on all these different issues. I mean, we talked about the economic issue. We talked about sort of, we talked about diversity, but also even, I mean, maybe touching on some of the issues that, I mean, I guess we even have kind of a libertarian streak as well.
Yeah, and again, going back to the whole idea of the Radical Center, just because I dislike libertarians doesn't mean that there can't be some nuggets of truth in libertarian philosophy. So, yeah, I just sort of can choose, and I don't wholeheartedly reject any ideology just because. And I think that's the way the Radical Center should work. You use whatever tools you can to advocate for a better society.
Yeah, and basically the Radical Center, it could be a bit, I mean, it would be a big tent movement. It's not an actual movement, but we're just sort of brainstorming, but it could include a lot of diversity of opinion. It's not necessarily, it would be definitely a lot less rigid in its thinking than all these previous movements. I think it could have a very broad appeal if it had the organization. But basically, it's very difficult to put together something from scratch. But I think the best thing that what you're basically doing is just putting the ideas out there, and if they're good ideas, they can spread. People will read your blog and they'll start thinking about it.
Right, and I know that my blog does not have a huge audience, although traffic's modest, but I sort of, whenever I write a post, I sort of try to write it in a way that many regular people could sort of relate to it. You'll notice that I don't use terms like cultural Marxism anymore. I sort of try to make my posts relatable, and I think that even though there's no movement, I think that people could be galvanized into supporting such a movement, because I even remember the black comedian Chris Rock basically had a routine where he said, you know, the Democrats are idiots, Republicans are idiots, you know, just be a person. And I think that sort of sums up what the Radical Center should be all about.
Well, Barry, Guy, it's been a really great show.
Yeah, great conversation.
Thanks for being on. That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.